see politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Hey guys, welcome to the Everyday Warrior podcast. I've got Nick Thompson here. Nick, you've got a new book coming out called Running Ground, A Father, A Son in the Simplest of Sports. Simplest, I don't know if that's the best descriptor.
I think running, it's the most human sport, right? You can do it. You just put on your shoes and you can run. You don't have a racket. You don't need a ball. You don't need another person. It's yourself. And there's a lot that comes from that.
I used to be a runner and I ran cross country.
Awesome.
Track, was going to go into college and run cross country and track. And I just quit. It's one of the hardest things I've ever
done. Why'd you quit?
I hated the feeling before a race.
Oh, just like the nerves.
Gut wrenching feeling. It just got old.
But that's good. It's like cortisol, right? It's like it's actually an adaptive response. Like we get nervous because we're priming ourselves to run.
Yes. I think I found more love for running once I wasn't doing it competitively. And you said it's you versus you. There's nothing like a runner's high.
Yeah.
And, especially if you're doing it to a high degree. But I want to go into your background because you've lived one hell of a life. Born and raised in
Boston.
We'll forgive you for that. California boy. Not a big supporter of the Patriots or the Red Sox. And then went to a private grammar school. Was it a boarding school?
Went to a boarding school, yeah.
Okay. And then from there to Stanford. And I'm sorry, was it political science?
I did political science and environmental science.
And of course, naturally, political science, you're writing a lot.
Yep.
And that sort of became your core focus. This is obvious. You must love writing.
Oh.
There's something therapeutic to it.
Writing is thinking, right? I mean, when you write, you're actually getting to process your own thoughts and understand yourself better. I love it.
Changing with AI.
Well, that's a huge thing right now. It's a huge thing for my business, right? As CEO of The Atlantic, like I have to figure out what AI is going to do to the creation of stories, the way we read stories, the way the internet works. Absolutely.
Is there a fear amongst journalists right now that AI could potentially replace them?
Oh, absolutely. Totally. I mean, and it's different depending on what kind of journalism you do. Like one of the things we think at The Atlantic, we do really complicated stories where you go and you call people and you write a long piece and you write it with voice, right? Those things are hard for AI. Who knows what, AI will be able to do in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Right now, we have a pretty good moat. But if you're doing like basic sports stories, you're doing stuff like that we did as young journalists in our 20s, like that stuff can be replicable with AI.
And so first off, The Atlantic does. If you guys haven't seen The Atlantic, it's massive. An American magazine, still both in print.
Yeah. In fact, we've increased the number of print issues. We are probably the only publication in the world, in part because of AI. Yeah, I like that look. I hope if you're just listening on the podcast, you're not looking at the video. Mike's face is like, what the hell are you talking about? Who did I bring into the studio? So the logic is that AI changes the whole way the internet works, and it gets really confusing. And all those intermediaries, you don't know what's going to happen. We have no idea what's going to happen with Google search, right? So we have to reach people. So we want the most direct way you can. The United States Postal Service, maybe seems old fashioned, but that is direct. You subscribe, we send you a magazine. Nothing's going to get in the way.
So is it a subscription model only, or are you guys shelving in stores, C-stores?
We sell a few in stores, not really. It's subscriptions and advertisements and live events, which we sell advertisements to.
The exposés that you guys do are phenomenal.
Yeah, they're great. They're great. Our reporters are amazing.
And I will say you guys punch at both sides, which is a beautiful thing.
We try to. We make everybody mad, which is good.
Yeah, so is life. So is life. If you try to sell to everyone, you're going to sell to no one.
You're going to sell to no one, and you're going to get caught in a trap. And it happens to media, right? If you start to cater towards a particular audience, this is particularly true now because of the way social media algorithms work. The algorithms will tune themselves. So then you can only do that, right? So it's a trap, and you really don't want to do that.
Let me ask you this, because you've had a long career, CBS,
yep.
Editor-in-chief at Wired.
Yep.
And there's been a lot of uproar about, you know, people mandating that journalists write a certain way, you know, with the Washington Post and in their respective boards. Do you guys approach it a different way? I mean, do you give carte blanche to your reporters or journalists to follow what they feel is the truth?
Yeah. I mean, that's the goal of The Atlantic, is to have the world's best writers collective. Like, hire the very best writers, the smartest people you can. We hire unbelievable talent. Not a lot of them, but unbelievable talent. And then they write about what they're passionate about. Now, it's not carte blanche. They have to be fact-checked, right? You have to be accurate.
Great statement.
But, like, otherwise, you go and do what you do.
Well, I mean, but how much of the writing is opinion-based, op-eds?
There are opinion pieces, but they're fact-based opinion pieces. Like, we like reported essays that have a point of view. And I should add, I'm the CEO. I'm not the editor-in-chief.
So yes,
the
I know.
Calls
yes.
on the editorial are his calls. I just try to make the business work so he has enough money to hire all the best people.
What's your staff right now?
About 300 people.
300 people.
Yeah.
That's big.
And we're growing. We're hiring tons and tons of people.
But from a cultural standpoint, I mean, it sounds like you guys set the guidelines. Opinion is absolutely, as long as it's fact-based.
Yeah.
And you have so a strong opinion of it.
Yeah, you can have a strong opinion. You can say this is absolutely wrong or this is absolutely right, and you can write it. But it's got to be fact-based. You got to report it. You know, you've got to be beautiful writing. Like, we do have some requirements.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I'd be interested to sit in one of those meetings. And I know you're the CEO. Have you ever sat in some pretty heated debates in Atlantic?
So I don't sit in the editorial debates.
Yes.
Right? Like, we have, it's actually a pretty important principle, like total church and state. Like, I don't know what we're going to publish today, right? Because if I did, like, maybe, and if I were unethical, maybe I'd say, well, you're criticizing our advertiser. You can't do that. Or maybe you should write a nice story about this person who's their advertiser. You know, I have a business deal. I'm going on Mike's podcast tomorrow. Don't say anything mean about Mike, right? Like, you don't want the CEO in the editorial meetings, right? Once the story comes out, I'll like fight to the death to defend the writers and defend what we did. But I'm not there in the early parts of the conversation, which is different because I spent my whole life on the other side of the wall.
Yes.
But we have total separation.
You just hear about it after the fact. Once it's made an uproar
in public. No, we'll run stories just like obliterating advertisers on the days that I'm meeting them, which is awkward and weird, but it's better to have independence.
Yeah, I'm sure they appreciate that in some way. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So, you know, what drove you to drive this book?
I wanted to write this book. You know, I'm a storyteller. I thought it was a great story. So, it's a story. The book is the story of my father's crazy life. He has sort of a remarkable rise and then a little bit of a fall. I used to describe my parents by saying, my mother's an art historian and my dad runs a male brothel in Bali, right? Like, you know, complicated life. He's got an amazing life we can get into where, you know, John F. Kennedy says he's going to be president before Kennedy becomes president, right? Like, he goes to Andover, goes to Stanford, scholarship, comes out of like Bacon, Oklahoma, Rhodes Scholarship, marries into my mother's family, like seems like he's going to become a senator, all of this stuff. And then alcohol comes out of the closet, chaos, but loves me the whole way, right? So that's the story of my father, and we connect through running, right? So that's one part of the story. Another part is my part, where I'm a decent runner when I'm in high school and, you know, a little bit at Stanford, though not good enough. I leave the team after freshman year. And then I, you know, take it back up, and I'm not that good. And then I'm pretty good in my 30s. I run 2:43 marathon, which is cool. Like, you win gift certificates at, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods, right? And then in my 40s, I become one of the best in the world, right? And I like set records, set an American record in the 50K. I'm now top ranked in the world in the 50 mile for my age. Like, that's an interesting story. Like, why did I get so much better in my 40s and I wasn't in my 30s or my 20s? Like, and that's a story about how you recognize talent, how you recognize your limitations, how you work. So that was an interesting story. And then I focus on a bunch of other runners who I've competed with or known along the way who teach you about pain through running. Not just like the pain you feel while you're running, but like hard things in life. So that's the book, tying those three threads together. I thought, that's a cool story. I'm going to learn a lot about myself. I'm going to help think through my father. I'm going to meet all these interesting people. That's why I did it.
Let's start with your father.
Yeah.
And one, sounds like a absolutely high-performing individual with the list of accomplishments you just blurted out.
He's certainly a smart dude and certainly an interesting dude. And certainly a wonderful man.
And in alcoholism?
Alcohol, like, he had alcohol addiction, he had sex addiction, he had a bunch of problems.
Was that a lifelong struggle or did it manifest later in his life?
Alcohol was a struggle starting kind of when his career prospects start dipping, like in the mid-30s, right? Mm. When you're a young man, a promise, like he whom the gods wish to destroy, they first make promising. You come out and you come out of like the childhood he came out of, and then like you're king of the world. Like I got some of his Rhodes Scholarship recommendations, you know, asked Oxford for him. And like a Stanford professor's like, this is the best student we've had since Herbert Hoover, right? Like crazy stuff, right? Like this kids like this come along once in a generation. Not like this kid got great A's, you know, got A's and was good in my class, but like this is the best we've ever seen, right? He comes through, he goes to Oxford, he's on top of the world. And then things don't really work. He starts drinking and then he's starting to deal with his sexuality. So the alcoholism starts like, I found all his diaries. You know, that kind of starts in the 70s where his diaries are all about alcohol. The sort of the sex addiction and the loss of control, that happens much later. That happens in like the 90s when he's in his, you know, after 40, in his 50s. That's when that stuff gets really bad. And like then financial chaos and all that, that happens around then too.
Cascading effect.
Cascading effect, yeah.
Did that change your relationship with alcohol on a personal level?
I've always had, I think, a healthy relationship with alcohol. I've never drunk too much. I've never worried about it. In part because I've been a runner for so long, yes. Right? Like running can be an excuse, right? Like some people, if they're a runner, they like, it gives them an excuse to drink. I'm going to run 10 miles. But for me, it's always been the opposite, right? Which is I've got to perform so I can't drink. So I never drank in high school and college to excess. I've never done it. So I've never had a problem with it.
We had a very different experience. we would rage the Saturday night after a cross country
meet. Really?
Oh yeah. And then we used to attend Oregon, University of Oregon, of course, Track City, USA.
Oh, yeah.
We used to attend their track and cross-country camp, and it was just like one big party the entire time. Still had to run during the days. But no, I know a lot of people have different approaches. You know, I've seen people that grew up with, I'll just use the word, an alcoholic parent.
Yeah.
And there's only two options. You either repeat it.
Right.
Or it's a completely different relationship with alcohol, and I've even seen that within my family.
Well, that's my father's father, my paternal grandfather, alcoholic. My father was well aware of it, tried to stop it, and yet repeated it, you know, repeated all the foibles of his father. And, you know, I'm a little kid, and I'm like pouring out the bottles of wine under the porch. I'm like tearing up his cigarettes, right? Like, so I learned to think of alcohol as an evil thing then. Mm-hmm. But I've never been a teetotaler, but I've, you know, try to keep it in control. And I think probably part of the reason I've never had a problem with it. I must be biologically, you know, aligned towards having a problem with alcohol, like given how much alcoholism there is in my family. But I haven't had a problem.
That's good.
Yeah.
It's amazing the outlets once things start to fall apart that people go to, whether it's sex addiction, alcohol, drugs,
gambling. This is part of the question that I was seeking in the book. Like there are a bunch of things that motivated the book, but part of it was, you know, when I look at my life, one of the things that clearly motivates me through and through is to not become my father. Like I'm very similar to him in lots of ways, and I always was seeking his approval. I went to the same schools, we're incredibly close. You know, I was always trying, I always wanted him to like love and support me, which he always did, and I desperately didn't want to be him. And I was terrified when I was 40, he posted this note on my Facebook page, right? Public Facebook page, like lots of people follow my Facebook page. He's like, hey, Nick, you got a great life, great job, wonderful wife, like wonderful kids, but all men's lives fall apart at 40. Like, good luck, man. I was like, wait, what are you talking about? Right? But it also was like, it reminded me, okay, like I'm not gonna fall apart at 40, right? And one of the things that I believed was that running hard would help me not fall apart. And that's part of what increased the intensity in my 40s.
And was your father an athlete as well?
He ran. Yeah, so he brought me into running. So I ran with him when he was still married to my mother when I was 5 or 6. He was a runner, and I would run a little bit with him, like run a couple miles. It seems crazy, but now that I've got a 5-year-old, like I think I ran 3 miles when I was 5. And then more importantly, I watched him. He ran marathons. You know, this very small window in the 80s. But I watched him in the 1982 New York Marathon, a really important moment for me, just to see him like strong and tough, trying to break 3 hours in the marathon. That you know, lodged itself deeply up here.
So you took the elements from your father that you highly respected, but understood that you didn't want to repeat some of the patterns is what it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, if you knew my dad, you definitely wouldn't want to repeat some of those patterns, but you also want some of it. The man's amazing.
To be compared to Herbert Hoover, which guys beyond president, you know, the Hoover Institute at Stanford, which is a clearinghouse for, I would say, national security or policy and politics.
Yeah. It's an incredible institution with all kinds of scholars. Like Hoover led a amazing life, right? He grows up, he's like spends his life mining. He grows up in this like sort of terrible life where all these, you know, all the people around him die. He becomes a mining engineer, makes all of this money, right? And then goes and like, you know, helps after World War One, like providing aid and food. I mean, the guy's incredible. Yeah. Like maybe not the most successful president, Great Depression and all that, but like really admirable pre-presidency. And to have to be compared to him by Stanford administrators, you know, pretty important and pretty impressive.
I would say. And this does go into, we talked about it. This is not your first book.
No.
The first book is very interesting.
Yeah.
And as you're talking about that, you know, I'm thinking of the Hoover Institute. We got an opportunity, this was 2014, to sit down with Secretary Shultz, who I found phenomenal.
Yeah.
And, you know, people love him or hate him, depending on which way his policies.
People mostly like him now, right? The Shultz, like, he's not a boogeyman on the right.
No. He did phenomenal things, but bestowed upon us like his six lessons in life. And so your grandfather, most people don't know, was
Paul Nitzer. Yeah. So Paul Nitzer, this is my mother's father. And he's very little in, you know, my new book is not, it's not about him. He just has a couple of mentions, but he was, you know, he served every U.S. president in some way or another, except for kind of Jimmy Carter, from FDR to first Bush, right? And he's in different capacities, and he's lead arms negotiator, he's undersecretary of defense, he's secretary of the Navy. And he's just this amazing character who's always there. He's always fighting for his principles. He writes NSC 68. My favorite thing about him, though, is he serves all these presidents. He more or less gets fired or kicked out by Eisenhower. He gets demoted by Kennedy. Kind of a big problem with Johnson, kind of gets kicked down by Nixon, tries to join the Carter campaign, gets booted out of it. Like everybody is like, you know, he's always getting kicked and he's always getting up and he's doing it again. Oh, and then he gets, you know, fired by Bush, right? Like sort of an amazing record of a guy who just will not lie down, right? He just, all right, I'm going to come and I'm going to take a lower job and I'm going to work harder than everybody. I'm going to do better than everybody else. An amazing character. So my book was called The Hawk and the Dove. It was the story of Nitzer, who's the hawk through the Cold War, George Kennan, who's the dove, diametrically opposed views, American foreign policy, but also friends. And they're the two Americans who are involved in every major foreign policy decision from 1945 to 1990. Like lots of people are more important at any moment, but no two other people are as important for as long. And these two guys disagree on everything. And in fact, believe the other's policies will lead to the end of the world, and yet are friends and respect each other. So I thought that was a great story. So that was my first book.
The refreshing thing about that is two people who, let's say, had very divergent trains of thought or beliefs, but still had the ability to be best friends, to agree to disagree.
Yeah, we need more of that in America.
Oh, hell yes, we do. Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. You can't have conversations anymore. That is amazing. Yeah. And, you know, we talked about Reykjavik. He was there.
He was there.
The Cold War. And for those that maybe don't know that, go watch the recent Reagan film. It covers that in length as one of the most important parts of his presidency.
Yeah.
From which was
my grandfather loved Reagan. He loved Shultz.
He did.
I thought Shultz was one of the best Secretary of States he ever served under. The one story I remember is, I can't remember. He was like at the same level with this other guy. And basically Shultz was like, I can give one of you the bigger office with the bathroom, and I can give one of you the office next to mine, right? And my grandfather's like, I'll take the one right next to you. And the other guy's like, I'll take the one with the bigger office with the bathroom. Like, which guy do you think lasted the whole administration, right? That's the right choice to make,
you know? To get the wisdom, access the wisdom from
Schultz. Access wisdom, forget the bathroom.
Well, how much younger than Shultz was he?
Oh, he's quite a bit older.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, my grandfather, he was probably 20 years older than Shultz.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. If you were 79 in Reykjavik.
Yeah. He was born in 1907, right? I mean, like he was a young man like during the Truman administration. I mean, I sometimes think about that in my life. Like, I feel like I'm kind of old, right? Like, my God, I just turned 50, right? And I look at my grandfather. When he was 50, his career was nowhere, right? He was just getting going. Like, he really kind of started to pick up steam in the Kennedy administration when he was 54. And then he had another, 30 years. So you know, if you're listening to this and you're 53, go look at the career of Paul Nitza.
And it's not like he had an easy ride.
No.
Up to his 50s. You look at those generations, World War I, Great Depression, World War II. I don't feel like our generation has really been tested. Like, oh yeah, COVID, I get it. That was a drastic change.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of lost life. There's no words I can say about that, but we've not been tested like that generation has been tested.
Yeah. I mean, he's like a slightly peculiar generation. He's born in 1907, so he's too young to fight in World War I, and he's too old to fight in World War II. He serves in the Strategic Bombing Survey, right? So he goes to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, like looking at the damage of nuclear weapons. And that's his first big government job, is to report back on what nuclear weapons did. And so he takes that, and that informs his views of arms control.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you could take it two ways. You could go to Hiroshima and say, like, you know, oh my God, we should, you know, get rid of those things completely. Or you can go and say, oh my God, look at the awesome power. Let's get the game theory right so they're never used again. Right? That's Nitza's position. That's what he takes from it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Cat and mouse or chess.
Yeah.
From here on. Let's hope that never does get employed.
So then back to my father. So then this is the interesting thing, right? So my father, who grows up in Oklahoma, totally outside of DC power establishment, and then, like, you know, comes to Oxford, marries my mother into that family, right? So into this prominent family, they get married while Paul Nitza is the Undersecretary of Defense. So there's this, like, my dad was this super promising Rhodes Scholar, amazing guy, you know, marries into this big family, you know, important politician, like, it really looked like he was on track. Mm.
Life is ebbs and peaks.
Yeah, absolutely.
So within the book,
yeah,
you talk about 9 lessons using running as a parable for life.
Yeah.
And I want to get into these. First is, our limits are truly in our heads, which I don't think anyone will disagree with, but people have very different views on this. I want to hear yours.
So this is very specific, and it's based on, it can be basically, I can synthesize it into the story of two races. First one is in high school. So I start running. I start running because I get cut from the basketball team. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. I go out there and I run. I'm running the 2 mile. And I go out there and I run them at like 11:40, you know, or 11:30, right? So that's 5:50 a mile, 5:45 a mile, whatever. It's okay, right? It's not that good for a high schooler. But at the end of the race, I'm just exhausted, right? Like, I can't go any faster. And then my coach is like, you know what, Nick, you're gonna run New England's. Why? Okay, sure. And you sort of had a hunch. And I was like, okay, well, if everything is perfect, I'm gonna run 11:30, right? That'll be my best time. So I'll run 5:45. And I knew exactly how many seconds per lap it would be. And I was like, okay, if I go all out, I can get that. And then I get put on a track, and the track's like a different size, right? I can't remember exactly what it is, different shape. And they start calling out splits, and the splits seem right, right? But I'm kind of way ahead of where I should be. Like, I'm not at the back of the pack. I'm sort of towards the front of the pack, right? And then I go through a mile, and they're like 5:25. I've never run a mile in 5:25. Like, maybe they mismeasured it. I finished the race in 10:48, right? So I've set a school record for sophomores. And there's no way I could have run that had I known how fast I was going, right? The only way I could run that fast was that I didn't know how fast I was going. Because my firm belief is that the way pain works in running, it's not physiological the way we think of it. It's not like when you stub your toe and it hits a nerve and hurt your muscles. Pain is your brain like telling you to slow down because it's scared that you're going too fast, you're working too hard, you're going to lose homeostasis. And so what happens, the reason you slow down in a race is you think you're hitting your limits, or one of the main reasons you slow down. And so what happened in that race is that because the track was weird and I didn't know how fast I was going, it reset. I reset, right? Same thing happens again in my 40s, where I think, like, from age 30 to age 43, I ran tons of marathons, right? And they're all were like 243, 244, 242, right? All around the same thing. And then I meet these coaches when I'm 43 years old, and they're like, yeah, I think you can probably go a lot faster, right? I was like, all right, well, maybe I can go under 240 again, but that's gonna be hard because I'm aging, I'm slowing down. And then they kind of reset my mind and they reset my expectations, and then boom, I run 229, right? Which is totally different, right? It's a whole different class of marathoning. And if you told me in 2018, you'd said, what are the odds that you can run a 229 in 2019? I would have said, you know, 0 out of 1,000,000, right? But they kind of tricked my mind and they re-tricked me. They sort of got me to believe that I could go faster, and they got my brain to believe I could go faster. And then presto, I did it. So it wasn't obviously there are physiological elements, obviously the nutritional elements, obviously I train differently, but it was really about expectations and what you fear.
Do you believe we're training the next generation to think beyond their limits? I mean, so this is my fear, is things are drastically different than when we grew up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all believe we have limitations because we're told we have limitations. But we're not putting our youth in situations to build the self-confidence that, you know what, I actually can do the thing that, things that people say are impossible.
Right. Because it's, you know, it's not like if you'd gone to me and you said, Nick, you can run a 229, you're the best, you can do it. Like, that's not what it, what, that's not what gets you there. You have to, like, it's this really this deep, hard work, this pushing, this failure, this exploration of your own limits. And so certainly with my kids, you know, one of the reasons I have that, they play elite soccer, they play these team sports, they work really hard at it. And part of what I love, and with these coaches who are like super tough and like, you know, not the sort of the, this is a team in Queens where every kid's an immigrant, right? There's like, there's no screwing around and they're playing all over the place. And older guys team, like one, you know, biggest tournaments you can win, regionals, all that stuff. Like, I love that because they're getting kind of kicked and pushed and being told to go way harder and push themselves really a lot.
It is, I'll give you an interesting one. I don't know if you just saw this, the discussion of having no homework when kids leave school. And I think, you know, as you talk about limitations, you've got to put the work in to build the confidence that you can do these things. And I'm just using that as an example of current society. Most people stay in a safe space. This is my opinion, because it's easy.
Yeah.
It's because you experience no pain. You're in an environment, you know, you usually can control the controllables and limit your let's say, exposure to uncontrollables. And we don't push people outside their comfort zones where true learning and growth take place.
Yep.
That defines my career. That was my career in the military. It was, to a large degree, my parents. But, you know, as we talk about breaking down limitations and getting, you know, it's not even this next generation. It's our generation. It's every generation. It's an interesting problem that we're not going to solve here. But
I'll say a couple things. So one, like the attitude about work, I've always worked really hard. And part of it was because my dad, you know, told me to work really hard. And part of it was my grandfather, right? Paul Nitza, where, you know, every time I would remember, like when he didn't have a job in government, everybody'd be like, oh, that's great. You know, you've got enough money, you can relax. He'd be like, no, I don't want that, right? Like, I want to work. It is work. Like, the man worked nonstop until he was 82 years old. He gets fired by Bush, right? Or gets pushed out by Bush. What does he do when he's pushed out by Bush? He like leaks a story to the paper, like trashing the guy who fired him. Like, the guy was like relentless, you know? Those lessons get passed down. And what's cool about running, like one of the best things about running is if you succeed, it's you. And if you fail,
it's you.
It's you, right? It's a great way to learn about yourself, right? And that's one of the things that is so empowering about the sport and also makes the sport hard.
You'd mentioned that pain is not the blocker. For me, the pain felt like the blocker a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I know that's your body's way of saying, hey, you're pushing too hard. But I mean, there were runs and I passed out, literally pushed myself until I passed out and I knew I was hurting. I want to get in on that subject. Pain. Wait. Go ahead.
You just fell over?
Literally collapsed.
Wow.
To exhaustion. Yeah. And I remember that was a 2-mile race to qualify for what we call the CCS, the Central California sectionals, and literally just went head first into the ground.
I mean, like, you know, I talk about like convincing your brain, like, so clearly something physiological happened where you passed some line you shouldn't have. Because your body doesn't want you to die, right? And so at some point, if you overcome the signals, like your body will shut down, right? So there have been studies of cyclists where you like give them like fentanyl or something so they can't feel any pain, right? And they'll just go like maniacs until they collapse, right? Like you don't want, like your brain signals are there for a reason. And so getting good at running is learning how to control the signals so that they don't stop you too early. It's not to get rid of the signals, right? Because you get rid of the signals and you're falling face first on the ground, and that's not good at all for anybody. You want to like learn where you're getting, you know, and there are limits, right? Like I could run a 229 marathon, 44. I couldn't run a 202, and no one in the world can run a 157, yeah. right? There are limits. The trick is to get your brain to get you to the safest maximum.
So you guys heard from Nick Thompson. If you dose a little bit of fentanyl, you'll be able to push. Number two, pain is information, not truth. I found this one interesting.
Yeah.
Good play on words. And I'd love to teach me or let me push back on what your trend is.
All right. So when I'm running, right? And if I go out and I run a race tomorrow, right? And you say, Nick, go run a 10K, right? Or even if I go out after we record this and I go run 12 miles, right? I'm going to feel pain pretty early on. And I'm going to feel it in weird ways, right? Like my shoulder might hurt, right? I might have like gastric distress. And it's going to move around my body. Like anybody who's a runner knows this, right? And that's pretty weird, right? Because the pain should be in like whatever area hurts the most first. But what's happening is your brain is kind of like trying to test out whether to slow you down. Like there's this conversation between your brain and your body. And so when I'm running a marathon and my shoulder hurts, right? At this point, I'm like, yeah, my shoulder's fine. Your brain, you can let like, not going to get me there, right? Like, you know, maybe my stomach gets a little bit of distress. I can kind of push that aside. Now there are real kinds of pain, right? And I can tell you when I've got like tendonitis in my knee, and I can tell you when there's like actual physical things happening. But part of the secret of running is to learn what pain is just your brain trying to get you to relax because it thinks you're going a little hard, and what pain is actually a physiological signal. Mm-hmm.
So how does that apply to life in context outside of running?
Yeah, so part of what it is you have to learn like, you have to learn when you can push yourself at an uncomfortable speed, like when the things holding you back are things that you can blow through, right? And like when you have a fear about doing something that, you know what, actually, I'm just going to do it. Sometimes you have a fear about doing something and you shouldn't do it, right? Like you're afraid to jump across that chasm and that chasm is too far for you to jump across. But sometimes like, oh, I can't get that thing done. You know, we can't get that project done, or like, I don't have time to do that. Or if I... like learning how to take those signals and when is it just information about fear and when is it real information about the world? And like learning to distinguish those two things because they're both real things is a big part of being able to be successful.
So number two is more psychological than physiological.
With physiological elements, like the line is like so much of what I love about running is this exploration of how pain works and like the sort of the deep conversation you can have with yourself once you start to realize that, you know, once you start to realize that pain is much more complicated than you're initially taught, like running gets much more interesting.
You know, I think there's definitely instances in life where you push beyond your limits. You look back and you say, you know what, that wasn't as bad as I thought.
Right.
And whatever my mind was telling me was wrong. You do that enough, it's like you build that scar tissue of identifying, hey, this is
totally,
this is information, not truth.
And well, you have to do hard things in life, and like it trains your body to do more hard things. And you need to rest, you need to relax. Like you finish a race, like you don't start the next race immediately. You like take some time. Bodies are real, right? Limitations are real, but the way to get you know, the way to get good at doing hard things is to do hard things.
And you will know this quote. I believe it was Rice University, JFK during the space race. Mm-hmm. He said, we're going to go to the moon.
Yep.
Not because it's easy.
Right.
But because it's hard.
Yep.
And there's a lot of truth there. And we do talk about, and we've had many guests on where, yes, we love to do hard things. It's actually the motto of one of my companies. But rest and reflection are key that many people don't recognize.
Yeah, and like the way you run, I mean, this is the way I train. Lots of people train differently. Obviously, a lot of people are faster than me. But the way I train is I have 3 hard days a week, but that means I have 4 easy days, right? You know? And like, so you're resting more than you're going at it. And even on those hard days, you're really only going hard for maybe it's 15 minutes of total hard work, or maybe it's a long run and it's 2 hours of kind of hard work, right? It's not that much hard work and there's a lot of recovery. And that is like how my body improves the most.
The pace is used there in the protocol that you're talking about, which is, again, transcends life. I mean, this is why we lead to what we call executive burnout. But so as I was preparing for this and thinking back to my cross country days, is we had a coach that ran as hard every single day.
Yeah.
And how my season would go is first meet, I'd be number one or two on the team. By the end of the season, I was at number seven.
Right.
Well, there's a few things. The guys just could have improved. They didn't train as hard during the summer. Maybe I was just at a higher, VO2 max threshold because I trained harder in the summer. But it was seemed like we had no rest and relaxation, and my body just couldn't take that.
Yeah. So what your coach should have done is like recognize that you trained hard in the summer, right? Because you are who you are. And then should have given you some rest days, right? In September, October, forced you, right? And then had your the other guys like train on those rest days because they didn't train that hard that summer. So they haven't put as much wear and tear on their body, right? Like, and figuring out that balance, like figuring out what everybody can take and how they can improve maximally, that's what a good coach is supposed to do.
That was a very old school approach to training.
Yeah.
That is what I love is that sports psychology and physiology have advanced so far beyond when we were in high school or college.
Yeah, totally.
They're training smarter. They're faster. They're stronger.
And the diet, like my diet in high school and college, it's like I just ate carbohydrates because I thought like marathoners carbo loaded, right? So my breakfast is like bagel after bagel, right? Like I'll have like a lot of bread for lunch and pasta for dinner. Not the best idea.
It was the same thing. My wife and I were talking about this last night. I'm not kidding you. Last night we're like, do you remember when they told us like, hey, you can only eat so many eggs mm-hmm. because they're high in cholesterol? And now it's like, yeah, hey, we were wrong. Right. And we're thinking back and we're like, how could the modern subject matter experts, the doctors, get that wrong? And she said, we'll follow the money. Cocoa Puffs mm-hmm. was paying them to say, yeah. So
anyway, there was all this stuff. I mean, I was blessed, right? At Stanford, I had my coach, this guy, Vin Lanana, who's, one of the most successful coaches in track history. I had a year observing him, and there's, a lot of stuff I picked up that I still use. So I was lucky in I was lucky in my coaches all the way through.
Let's see, did you run the radar dish?
Oh, of course. Oh, you mean up in the dish?
Up the hill? Yeah.
Yeah, hell yeah.
The golf course?
I ran the golf course a bit. I mean, I my favorite run. So after I left the team, I got hurt when I showed up and then like had a great recruiting class and I gave up on myself. Like obviously given how fast I am now, I could have been okay. Like I could have been on the team, not the top guy, but I could have been on the team, but I didn't realize that and I gave up on myself. But then I would just go run in the mountains, right? So I'd go bike to Windy Hill and go run up Windy Hill, run up a Ross Dare, or like, I loved that.
They used to have a Stanford Invitational on the golf course. Yes. Always loved that race because for whatever reason, I always did well in that course.
Oh, nice. They had high school kids who would go and run that. Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah.
Talent isn't where you start. It's how fast you improve.
Yeah. So this is really important for runners and it ties into what you said, right? So a lot of times there's this perception that you get, and this is a lesson that applies to running, but also other sports and to life. Everybody shows up for the first meet, and whoever runs best that first day has the most talent. And then
Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.
By the end of the season, maybe they're not the best, right? And like, so you showed up and you're the first. Everybody's like, oh, Mike's got all the talent. And then at the end of the season, you're seventh, right? And it's like, well, he didn't train that hard. He doesn't have the grit. Well, that's not it, actually. There's actually like an improvement curve. And some kids, you can have two runners who show up. On the first day, one runner is faster than the second. They can do the exact same workouts and be exactly as disciplined, right?
Yes.
And the second one's just going to improve better, right? Rate of improvement is talent, right? And it's harder to see, right? And I watched this in one of my sons where, once he starts training, like, whoa, that kid like improves so fast, like faster than his other teammates. And that's talent, right? And sometimes we mistake that. We don't understand what that is. And so if you're trying to think through, like, what are you talented at? Sometimes you're like, oh, like, I picked up the instrument and I couldn't really play it. I wasn't that good. I took classes for a little while. I didn't have that immediate knack where I had this other friend who has perfect pitch. Yeah, sure, perfect pitch is talent. But actually maybe like your rate of improvement is a super important talent. And so in running, I've noticed that like I don't have a very high VO2 max, right? I don't have some of the indicators of talent, right? Like, if you throw me out, if you took all the runners on that Stanford team and you had us untrained and you had us run 1,000 meters, maybe I come in last, right? But I do have some God-given gifts. One is I don't get injured, right? I get injured very little. And two, I improve really well when I train, right? And that's actually talent. It's not just grit, it's talent, right? And it's luck and it's good fortune.
That's an interesting take on talent. And I did write a book called The Talent War.
Yeah.
And I like the adaptability piece, your ability to adapt, improve, and really what it came down to us is it's not, and there always is an element of nature.
Yeah.
That genetically you may be more superior than me, you higher, you know, higher intellect. But ultimately the person's mindset, I mean, as I read the description on these, which are great, you talked about fixed ability.
Yeah.
And that is a mindset thing.
Yep.
Through and through. It's the belief that, you know, we could say it's a growth versus a fixed mindset that, you know, I can tap out of my ability at this point and I just can't excel beyond
can't
that.
Can't do it, right?
So the improvement, that's the first time I've heard that. And I'm going to write that down. I'm actually going to plagiarize that.
Good.
Which I'm known for. So
I think it's an important lesson. And when you're looking at, you know, you're looking at who to hire, right? And it's also like, okay, this person maybe... Maybe there's a little more electricity in the light bulb, but maybe actually this, you know, over a bit of time, this person's going to learn more. Even if they work hard, it's not work ethic. It's just actually they're going to improve more.
What makes me think is how many people, because that improvement curve is going to be different, naturally different strokes for different folks. It's going to be longer for others than shorter. How many people give up well before that improvement curve? They're about to hit the hockey stick.
Yeah.
And
well, and I wonder about this with myself in college, right? So I joined the team, right? And I'm the 10th best recruit, right? I was good. I won New England meets or whatever, but I'm 10th best recruit, right? And there's seven guys who score in a cross country meet and you have 4 years of them. So if you're the 10th best freshman, you're not so great. And I'm injured, right? So I spend the fall running in that pool. You probably ran in that pool. Right? It's not a good place to be, right? And so by the end of the year, I'm like, you know what? I'm just not good enough, right? I'm not good enough, right? Like, and it's not that I don't try enough. I'm just not good enough. But I was good enough, right? I actually don't regret having stopped the team because college opened up a million things. But it's an interesting lesson, like to learn later in life that you kind of underestimated yourself.
Yeah, I can say there's plenty of timeline I can point back to in my life and agree with that.
Yeah,
where I quit too early for one reason or another. Intense running helps an intense job and vice versa. I don't know.
Oh, totally. Totally. No question about it. I mean,
Are you talking about, there's an argument to be made that, you know, peak physical fitness affects your ability to deal with stress, oxidation, fatigue, things along those lines. But I'm sure there's a different story here.
That's part, I mean, I believe, so the first, if you do intense running, you learn not to give up, right? And you learn not to give up in your workout and you learn to concentrate, right? And you learn that if you're going to run a fast marathon or you're going to run a fast ultra, right? Or even you're going to run a fast mile, you're training your body to concentrate, right? And you are training to like push things aside that should be pushed aside and focus on things that matter, right? And that is a skill that applies to your work, right? So there are ways that like my running competes with my job, right? Obviously for time management, right? We're going to finish this podcast and I can either go back to my work to-do list, which I was on right before we came in, or I can go for a run, right? And like competitive, right? There's time. On the other hand, like I will do long all-hands sessions, right? I do like intense preparation for board meetings. I can concentrate for a really long time, right? And I can stay focused for a really long time. Now, is that because I've been a runner and done all these long races? I think it's part of it. I also think discipline is cumulative, right? You get up and you do something hard, right? In fact, one of the things I like to do when I get up, I like to look at the to-do list and say, okay, what is the task that most scares me right now? Right? Like, not like what is the hardest task, what is the biggest task, but we all on our to-do list, there's like, I don't really want to respond to that email for whatever reason, right? But you do that, right? And I think it's cumulative. Like there's this alternative theory that you have a fixed amount of discipline, right? You have like, you know, you have like a pound of discipline in your pocket when you wake up and you spend an ounce here and an ounce there. I think it's the opposite, right? And I think actually as you do things that require discipline, you kind of get more. So that's my view.
It's compounding.
Yeah.
No, I like that. Except this 2-hour Zoom call in focusing, that must be a superpower because if it's over 30 minutes, you start to lose me.
Well, but you can do long podcasts, right? And you're staying focused in your long podcast. Like that is a form of intense concentration. Now, does that help your training? Probably. Does your training help your podcasting? Probably.
At 100%. What I can argue is that those meetings are not well run.
Right.
With a established agenda. No, I'm kidding. Non-negotiable daily practice. You just talked about discipline.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine your schedule. What time do you get up in the morning?
I pretty much always get up at like 6:15.
You get up at 6:15?
Yeah, so that's late, right? You think I'm getting up at like 4 or something?
So I'm a 4:30 guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But are you a late worker?
Yeah, I work until like, 10, 11, right? Okay. I try to get a good night's sleep.
10, 11. Okay. Still, that's late.
Not that late. That's late. Well, my kids go to bed. So my schedule is like this when I'm at home, right? I get up at 6:15. I work until 7, 7:15. I make the kids breakfast. We have fun. Walk the little guy to school. Whatever's going on. Like, we have a good time together. As I've got 3 boys. We hang out. It's great. I run to work, right? So I'm getting my workout in after the session. I run to the office. I then work till 6, 6:30, wherever I work. So I'm like working 9 hours in the office. I run home, right? Clearing my mind.
And what's the distance?
5 miles.
Okay. Right?
So I'm 10 miles running. I then play with my kids. I pick them up at soccer practice. Mondays, I'm going to be coaching my kid at soccer. I do physical fitness with the 11-year-olds. It's actually kind of amazing. We can get into that because I think it's partly why I don't get hurt. You've got a little one, right?
So I've got 11 months. 11 months.
So I will say that the best cross training in the world, I'm going to tell you, so this is a diversion, but it's a story, but you're going to like it as a dad. I went and saw this physical therapist. And I had just started having an issue with my knee. And he's like, well, when was the last time you were hurt? I was like, well, I haven't missed a workout in 12 years. He's like, you haven't missed a workout in 12 years? And I was like, no. And he's like, well, what do you do for cross training? And like, you run all these miles. He's like, I don't do anything. He's like, what do you do for stretching? I was like, well, I'm just stretching. He's like, what do you do for weightlift? I don't weightlift. And he's like, well, what do you do? I was like, well, I play Nerf football with my kids. I like lift them in the water. I play like, we have this game where we play blind monster and I'm like tackling them. He's like, that's it. Like, that's all the eccentric motion that's like keeping you healthy. And he said, how old is your kid? I was like, well, the kid is 13. So it was 12 years ago that I started doing this. He's like, well, that's when you were last hurt, right? And so what I realized was like all this play was the best way to prevent getting injured. It was kind of an amazing realization. Now my kids are a little bit older, right? And so I'll go to the gym and I'll lift with the 15-year-old, right? And we do track workouts together. The 11-year-old, I like lead his soccer team in like mile running. I did a plank competition with the other day. Like, it's so much fun and it's really good for you.
The one thing I loved about soccer, I don't know if you do this, is basically the goal sprints. You start at one.
Oh, you goal, run.
Sprint mm-hmm. around, finish yeah. back at the, oh, used to love those.
Yeah.
Cause I'd always win. Always put out.
Yeah. Anyway, so.
The non-negotiable daily practice, again, goes back to, I think you are right. There is a compounding effect to discipline.
Yeah.
And people often ask, I'd love to get your opinion on this. Well, hey, I'm not disciplined. How do I build it? And I know my response, but I'd love to hear yours. And that's a difficult question to answer. And it's,
I'm not disciplined and how do I build it? I mean, so my view is like, every time you do something right, actually, it's funny. It's like this worldview, which came from a kind of an obscure George Kennan quote when I was working on the last book. And he was talking about American foreign policy failures, right? And he's like, every time you look deeply at a foreign policy failure, you realize that it was the cumulative result of like hundreds of bad decisions. And so what that means is that every time you make a bad decision, the next bad decision becomes a little easier. And he's like, and that's really depressing. But he's like, but then every time you do something right, it means that actually you're like the next possibility of having a good decision becomes a little bit easier, right? And so basically when you do things well, it creates this like tiny tailwind. When you do things badly, it creates this like tiny headwind, right? And so the way to build discipline is to just, okay, what is something I can do right now that is like something that's hard to do and that I should do, right? Maybe it's go for a run. Maybe it's eat this food I don't want to eat, or maybe it's like write a thank you letter that I don't want to write, whatever it is. And then you do it and then you try to build it into a habit. Right? And each time you do it, it makes the habit a little easier. And each time you don't do it, it makes that opposite habit a little easier. And part of what, like, back to my father, as I've thought about his life, like, part of the problem is that he didn't believe in habits. He kind of believed in, like, shooting the moon, right? Like, if his career wasn't going well, he'd be like, oh, I'm going to start this new institute. I'm like, Dad, you can't start this. I'm going to write this amazing new book. Dad, you can't, like, why don't you tie your shoes, right? Like, why don't you, like, clean your desk, right? And that'll get you on the path to writing the next great book, right? But like, you got to start somewhere else. And what I love about running is that it can teach you this. Like, you commit to running, you say, I'm going to run every day, right? And I'm going to run when it's 98 degrees, right? And I'm going to run when it's 23 degrees. I'm going to run when it's raining. And I'm going to run when like my foot kind of hurts. I'm going to run when I'm a little sick to my stomach. Like, I'm going to run wherever, I'm just going to run every day. I think it really does help you build good habits.
I love that answer. In iterative small steps.
Yeah.
Iterative small steps. We talked a little bit about this in Safe Spaces in True Learning and Growth. I mean, what we're going to talk about is embrace the discomfort zone.
Yeah.
And we say in the military, get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yep.
And I'll give you a perspective from the SEAL training, but I want to hear your perspective on this because I love this conversation. Is people look at SEAL training and they're like, oh, that's sadistic and it's crazy. And maybe it is in the eyes of whoever is making that evaluation. All it was designed to do, and it was designed with intentionality, is to push people outside their mental and physical comfort zones, because that's where they can truly assess somebody in their character.
Right.
And that's all it was. Trust me. And I went back as a BUDS instructor, not particularly focused on the physical part, but like I got no joy from watching young men in what you could say is arguably pain. I'm a solid believer that learning and growth, you've got to be able to push yourself outside those things and do those hard things that you're talking about.
And I mean, they make it easy to tap out, right? Like they put that, it's like so tempting, right? Like that's part of the teaching, right?
That's the amazing thing about it. That is a mind, I won't say the word, complete mind game. That's a complete mind game. Oh, just right there. If you just ring it three times, you're done.
It's a piece of cake.
We've got hot cocoa for you and a blanket. And yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you remove that variable and how many guys would just continue pushing through where it wasn't an option.
Right. And they're like, that's what tests you. I mean, that's an amazing thing about it. And I completely believe like you've got to like, there are times in life where you have to step outside your comfort zone and you have to push and do things that are incredibly hard.
You know, now that you've said that, the variable of the bell, I mean, do you consider yourself a burn the boats type of guy?
And when not you have set the bell?
And not, that may be a societal problem, is that we give people that easy button or that tap out button too often. But I mean, in terms of mentality, when you set your eye on something, do you burn the boats? And guys, by burn the boats, we mean you don't give yourself the option of quitting.
I'm not sure how to answer that because I don't know. You know, if I go a set out and I'm going to go and run 100K, right? So I just, 2 weeks ago, I ran this 100K in the mountains, you know, in upstate New York, right?
And in how many hours or how many days?
It was weird that it was 107K. Like, I don't know whether they're just trying to F with us, but it was, 66 miles, 67 miles. And it wasn't like I burned the boats and said, there's no chance I'm going to drop out. But I certainly went into the race with absolutely no expectation that I was going to drop out, and every single expectation and every single mental plan. Because once you start saying, well, if I hurt, I'll drop out. Once you give yourself that option. But I'll tell you another story, right? So the first time I ran an ultra, I did drop out, actually, right? And I, I was running this 50 miler and something happened to my Achilles and it really hurt. And I, went into the tent. That's funny you say hot cocoa and a blanket. You know what I had? Hot cocoa and a blanket, right? And I dropped out. And I have regretted that ever since. Like, I should have finished. Like, it's kind of a complicated call. I actually did injure my Achilles, and maybe if I kept going. But, like, I called the chapter about that race, the chapter in the book is called A Labrador and a Race for Wolves, right? And, like, I just wasn't ready to do that kind of a race and put myself through what I had to put myself through. And so part of the process of learning how to run ultras was to learn not to run like a Labrador, but to run like a wolf. And whether I've gotten there or not, I don't know, but I certainly haven't dropped out since, right? And every race has gone better. So I'm learning that. So am I a burn the boats kind of guy? I don't know. I don't know if I've been in the situation where I've had exactly that choice, but certainly I go in with a mentality that I'm going to finish no matter what. And actually, this is important. Here's this part is important. When I run a workout, I always finish, right? And I don't stop, right? Because in a workout, it's very easy to quit, right? Because no one is looking and no one is watching. A marathon, it's hard to quit because you have your friends on the course and like there's a lot of reasons not to quit. Maybe they have blankets and maybe they haven't. But in a workout, it's easy because you're alone and it's Prospect Park and nobody knows, right? And I know that. And so if I say I'm going to do six by a mile, I do six by a mile, right? Always. And I think that builds a really good habit. Because it's very easy to just do four by a mile because, you know, I'm tired and kind of, you know, every single time, every single runner in the history of the world who's tried to do 6x a mile after 4x a mile has had an excuse to stop because they've already done enough and it's good, right? That's the way mind works. And you just got to commit that if you're going to do 6x a mile, you're going to do 6x a mile.
That sounds insane. Maybe not 10, 15 years ago, but that sounds insane. I also have a hip replacement, so that's not happening anytime soon. We did talk about discipline compounds daily. This one's great. When scared, think bigger.
Yeah. You know, there's a story in the book, and it's one of the most helpful things anybody said. It was this, I was running a 50K, right? And I'd only run marathons. This is after COVID. And so I'm running this kind of weird 50K is 31 miles. It's not that different. But I had run, I don't know, 25 marathons up to that point. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to set the American record, right? And so I wanted to run like 31 miles. I think I had to run like 5:56 pace, right? It just felt impossible, right? Like, how can I do that? I like had this sense, I describe it as like, I wasn't afraid I was gonna die, but it was more than like that I was gonna get hurt. Like I just had this like, it seems a little like, maybe like a little bit of the fear you had running cross country when you were young. I don't know. I remember being in the hotel room, just like out of it. And so I call up this really smart guy, Brett Kirby, works for Nike and had, you know, worked with me on my running. I was like, Brett, you know, what am I supposed to do? And he's like, Nick, what do you think about sometime you did something harder? He's like, what about those times you ran those mountain races? You ran the escarpment run, right? And actually you were out there running for longer than you're gonna be running tomorrow. Yeah, that took you longer than 3 hours and 5 minutes. And what about that time you ran the Chicago Marathon? You ran a lot faster than 5:56 pace. You actually went a lot harder. It's like, think about all the times you've gone harder than you're going to have to go tomorrow, right? And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I start to like think about those, and then boom, I fall asleep. And like, I get up, I feel good the next day. And it was a really good way to reframe it, right? And I was trying to do that with my son. He's the 11-year-old, he's a great soccer player. He was very nervous about, you know, this game. He's like, he's in Spain. He's playing with this like Spanish pro academy, right? For 11-year-olds, mm-hmm. right? And he's gone to practice, and I'm like, hey, you're going to play in the game. And he's like, oh my God, right? Like, how's this going to work? I'm like, La Liga, you know, oh my God. And I was like, okay, well, let's like think about the other games that are really hard. Like, let's think about, it didn't work. I tried, like, you know, parenting's hard. Maybe I reframed, helped him reframe a little bit. And he did play in the game and he crushed it. But I was trying that same exercise. Like, let's think about like what about that game in the State Cup against Albertson? Like, think about how big they were. Think about how hard they played. Anyway, so I try that technique with my kids, but it's not a magic wand.
No, it's not. But just even the process of working through those conversations with them is so vital.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. Whether it's academics, it's sports, or even the social.
And I love situation. That he did it, right? And he went out there and he played. And then, like, you know, second half comes, coach says, you're going in right back, right? And so he's playing for FC Caddies. And he's got on, like, the uniform of the pro club. Spanish soccer kids, really good. He gets out there, first ball comes to him. He, like, traps it, turns, passes. It was great.
Again, my wife and I were talking about this. So I do have a 21-year-old daughter and a 17-year-old son. And hell, we're working through we're going about to start the college application process for him.
More power to you. Talk about do hard things.
pushing him to academically, he's great. He wants to be an architect.
Great.
So
great.
He wants to stay in Virginia. I'm trying to push him on Texas. We do things bigger here in Texas. You know, we're talking about our daughter who's now 11 months old. I apologize. And she said, well, you know, I'm like, let her try a lot of things.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, yeah, if she doesn't like something, you know, she can just quit. I'm like, if she starts something, she's going to see it through to the end.
Yeah.
Because there's a lesson to reinforce there, which is interesting. And we're going off topic here with kids.
Is it off topic?
It's a book. Not necessarily.
In some ways, it's a book about parenting, right? I mean, it's my father, my son, like my children. Like, actually, there's a lot about running. There's a lot about yourself, but there's actually like some lessons about parenting that I've gone through.
Your son is, your oldest is 15.
17. So the 17. Boys are 17, 15, and 11. Yeah.
Have they read this yet?
Oh, yeah. In fact, my 17-year-old was my wife was the first to read it. And then he read it and he's like, I learned some interesting things about my family, Dad.
No kidding.
Yeah.
What did they think? What was that? Beyond the family, they're like, this is exceptional.
Oh, they love it. Yeah, they really like my running. They think it's cool. They think it's exciting. I mean, they don't like it if I'm out running and they're up and they want me to, you know, do something with them. I try to run before they wake up or after they go to bed or, you know, whenever. But sometimes it comes into conflict. They don't like that. But they like that I do it. And they've all, like, they are all hyper-disciplined in different ways. Like, my older son doesn't do sports, but he is crazy focused on academics, right? And they're like, lots of nights where I'm like, God, this kid's working harder than I am, right? And so he's taken, I don't know whether he's taken that, whether whatever, but, like, certainly he has this trait that I had and that my father had and my grandfather had and my wife has, right? Like, my mother, you know, he's gotten that for academic excellence. The other boys, like, academics and athletics.
Good combination.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think athletics are so essential.
Oh, they're great.
For kids.
They're great.
Merely from, again, pushing them beyond their comfort zones, but the team aspect, the societal aspect.
And soccer in particular, like, we live in New York City, and, you know, take my 15-year-old, right? He plays on a team where, like, I don't know how many of the parents were born in America, but certainly only a couple, like, all over the country. Then he plays on a team where everybody speaks Spanish, like, plays in the Spanish pickup league, right? Where it's all, like, all immigrants, right? The league was actually shut down when there's, like, ICE raids, right? Like, there's real complexities around, but, like, which is, you know, tough stuff. And then he plays pickup games in the park next to us with all what guys from the West Indies, like, guys in their 40s and 50s who used to be, like, studs in their 20s. And now he's, like, at their level. It's amazing, right? And, like, think about what he's learning about the world and what he's learning about different cultures and what he's picking up from the music, from the conversations. It's just awesome, right? Soccer is the world sport. And it's, so he's getting, like, the team elements, right? And he's getting, like, cultural elements. I love soccer.
Love soccer growing up. It's because you're running just back and forth.
Yeah.
You're running down the field. It was fun. And yeah. They're definitely, yes, the most global sport for which America is not dominant.
Yeah, and it's about time. Let's get that U.S. men's national. I mean, their women are great, but the men need to step it up a little bit.
Well, hey, when you're going against the European teams or the Brazil team or the Mexico team, that's...
Well, I learned about this while watching my little kid. Like, they play for the best club in Queens, right? They play for one of, like, their guys who play in the U.S. men's national team who played for my kid's club. Pele's son played for my kid's club, right? My kid's club is awesome. But you go to Spain, you watch them train, and they're, like, doing weightlifts. They're doing film review at age 10, you know?
Just right? A different focus.
Like, they're out there for 3 hours, like, lifting weights, you know? Great.
Sounds like Russia in the 90s, 80s, 90s. Probably on a performance program of some sort. We won't get into that. So performance equals fitness minus fatigue.
Oh, okay. So this was also another thing I learned when I was, you know, getting more focused in my 40s. So, you know, the folks at Nike who were training me in 2018, 2019, you know, I'd be like, before a race, I'd be like, God, you know, they tell you not to run for like 7 days, 9 days. And I'm like, well, I feel like I'm losing my sharpness. And so the guy, Brett Kirby, who I just mentioned,
yes,
he like pulls up a chart. It was amazing. He's like, actually, Nick, you know what? I've got all your data because you've been wearing a heart rate monitor. And you've been wearing your watch and we've got it all. We've got it all right here. And here's your fitness, right? And he shows it going up, 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 up. And then he shows it going down a little bit. Right. And he's like, you know, you haven't run in 7 days and your fitness has gone down a little bit. Look, you can see it going down.
Kidding.
And he's like, and now here's your fatigue level. And it's like up, 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 up. And then he's like, and here's the gap between your fitness and fatigue. And if you look at the last 7 days, that gap has grown. Your fitness has gone down a little bit, but your fatigue has gone way down. And your performance capacity is your fitness minus your fatigue. Right. And he's like, if I had you run the marathon, you know, a week ago, well, your fitness is here and your fatigue is here, right? Versus here and here, you're gonna be a lot faster now. And I was like, oh, right? Kind of obvious, but like actually really smart and really interesting. And so I think about that when I go into, I don't know, like a board meeting, like really important. Okay, so I'm gonna my fitness and like how much I've prepared, how much I know, how much I'm ready, and what is my fatigue and what is my stress? And I'm gonna optimize that so that when I do the board meeting, I do the best I can. And so that's a good lesson. And I'm with my kids, when I'm trying to, like, when they've got these big tests and they've got all this, like, hard stuff, like, trying to work with them so they know you have to be maximally prepared, but you've got to rest, right? And you're going to do best. If all you care about is that test on Friday, you know, let's start studying on Monday and Tuesday and let's sleep pretty well on Wednesday and Thursday. You also want to study on Thursday and you want to, you know, study Friday morning when you're taking the metro in, but, you know, fitness minus fatigue. It's like that's where your performance is.
So that is interesting what you got from the data. And I'm sure they were collecting HRV, your recovery rate.
I don't actually, you know what's funny? I don't even know what they were feeding into the machine, right? Because I, This is in 2018, 2019. It's before I even tracked my own HRV.
You threw a wearable.
Yeah. So I'm wearing this Garmin. I'm wearing a heart rate monitor on my arm. I'm wearing a little RunScribe pod on my waistband. I'm wearing pods on my feet, right? So they're measuring everything and they're being sent. You know, the same guy who's like measuring Eliud Kipchoge's vitals is like also has this side hustle of like doing mine, right? So you have total faith. And then he's like looking at the course and he's like, looking at how fast I go around corners and how much I slow and like how much wind affects me. So yeah, these guys knew what they were doing.
Well, I see you're wearing a Whoop.
I'm wearing a Whoop right now. I'm tracking my HRV. I'm tracking my sleep. I wasn't wearing it back then. Yeah.
If you have, so with Whoop, there's a data scientist or a scientist, Kristen Holmes. If you ever have the opportunity to meet her, phenomenal.
Really?
Actually, NCAA champion coach for field hockey. Phenomenal. We worked with them heavily on a expedition we did where the sleep and recovery was substantially.
The parachuting expedition?
Parachuting expedition, which really was a glorified boys trip. and we had good purpose jumping in honor of her fallen. But it is amazing. Now you have near real-time access to physiological aspects of your performance from which you can make almost instantaneous decisions of, hey, I need to sleep.
Yeah.
Or I need to do this.
And I track a lot of stuff now. I mean, there's this interesting balance in, and it's one of the tensions I get at in the book. You know, we haven't talked about them yet, but there are five characters who I write about. And one of them is this, woman, Julia Lucas, who I write about because she's an incredibly intense athlete who she's actually homeless for a while as she's training. She becomes the fastest miler in the country. But she like can't get supporters, so she's like living in the forest in Oregon and like trudging to town, not telling anybody that she's homeless and training. But she has this really intense and complicated relationship between how much you measure and like how much you just run to be, free in the woods and with your spirit, right? And like that's a tension we all deal with, and I deal with it too. But I do track a lot, right? And I track when I'm running a race, I track my heart rate. I now track my body temperature. I track my pace. But sometimes in a race, like this ultra I ran 2 weeks ago, I turned it off. Right. And I like, maybe the sensors will record the data, but I'm not looking at it because you've got to let your mind run free in a race like that. And if you focus too much on the data, you can lose yourself. So there's a balance between sort of having infinite knowledge of how you're performing at a certain moment. And then just like, imagine you're a child running in the woods and you've got to sort of know when to associate and when to disassociate.
It sounds like for the 100K, you wanted to remove access to that information just due to the duration of that?
Not the whole time. Maybe I didn't do it the right way, but in the first like 10 miles, I watched my heart rate really carefully to make sure I didn't go above a threshold, to make sure I was going slow enough, right? And the second it went above like 115, right? I was like, slow down, right? You got a long way to go, right? And then at the end, like the last 30 miles, I just turned it to a screen where I couldn't see anything, right? Because I didn't want to be tracking like what my heart rate was or what my pace was or my time. I didn't want to worry like, am I going to finish? I finished in 13 hours and 1 minute. Like if I had been tracking, I would have been like obsessed for like the last 10 miles. Like, can I get a 12:59? And it's such a hard race and you're out there for so long and there's so much stress. It was 90 something degrees. You have to let your mind run free to be able to get done.
You use a word in here, peak.
Yeah.
Peak performance, which implies very much to an athlete that you're peaking on game day or for a race. Do you find it different with regards to, let's say, your average Americans who are in the business world of maintaining optimal performance over peak performance?
Oh, totally. Right. Yeah. Like at the Atlantic, I don't peak. Right. Like,
let's be honest though. You do peak for that board meeting you just mentioned that you're going to be at your very best, that you're going to make sure you're prepared, that you're.
And like today, there was one thing I had to do that was like really important, right? And I probably put like more mental energy. I had to like write comments on a document for one person and it really mattered, right? And like I focused really hard on that. But at the Atlantic, like it's really sustained, continued excellence every day that is going to make me best at my job. And there are things that you do that are more important and there are days that are more important and there are meetings that matter more, right? And you're meeting a client and there's $1 million at stake, or you're meeting a client and there's $20,000 at stake. Yeah. Like you have different amounts of preparation you do and different amounts you care at that. But my running life is it's different in that like you really focus on like 4 days a year, right? And the Atlantic, Maybe there are four board meetings a year and you focus a bit more, but really there's like 100 days where you've got like stuff you're really focused on.
The things you can't account for
yeah.
that happen out of the blue.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited for this book. One, was not able to get a copy prior to this podcast. I'll dig in.
Great.
Because
great.
Whenever you can take that analogy from a sport or some other profession and apply it to life, there's value. Guys, the book just came out. It's available on Amazon. So please check it out or anywhere books
anywhere
are sold.
Anywhere you buy books.
Excited to see how it performs.
Yeah.
And I just got a copy and I cannot wait to dive in myself. But I appreciate the time to come out here.
I hope you enjoy it.
And share the knowledge. Yeah.
I worked on it for 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a day job, right? So like you're figuring out the time to work on it is a little harder, you know, but I put a lot of time into it. I revised it a lot to make it shorter, you know.
What is the page count?
So it's 75,000 words, but I have a file of 60,000 words of stuff that I cut out at different points, right?
Like, no kidding.
Just because people's time is really valuable and I want every paragraph to have something in it of true value, right? Like, and when you write a book like this, like if I had to get it done in a shorter time period, it would have been a lot longer. Right? Like I worked really hard. And at the end I went through, I was like, okay, can this paragraph be one sentence shorter? Can this chapter be one paragraph shorter? Right? Because, you know, you want people to finish the book and you want it to be very information dense. And maybe I succeeded or failed, but I certainly tried. Certainly tried to respect your time.
And any writer knows how hard it is to cut down
yeah.
on wordage because you think everything you have to say.
Well, and not only that, but there's like, there are people I spent a lot of time interviewing, right, who now aren't in the book, right? And it's not because their stories weren't interesting and they didn't teach you something about running, but it just didn't fit with the flow yeah. and it didn't fit yes. with the structure.
Well, 5 years in the making, that's impressive. How many revisions of the final manuscript?
I don't know, hundreds? I mean, I think maybe the test is how many different versions. I'll say I have one friend who I do not pay, who read, I believe, 7 different versions beginning to end and gave me smart feedback on all of them.
Okay, so I was going to ask that. In terms of a review, you only use one person?
No. This one of the nice things about being a journalist and having worked at The New Yorker and working at The Atlantic and Wired is like all of my friends are great editors. Like I have so many great editors. My wife's an amazing editor. So I sent it to lots of different people and they gave me lots of different feedback and some brilliant suggestions from different people. Like, just to give you one example, the book starts and the introduction has been more or less the same since the beginning. First chapter is completely different. The first chapter is now a blow-by-blow account of the 2007 New York Marathon, which was a very important race for me. And I'd run it in 2005. I'd then gotten cancer. It had taken a long time to recover. And I came back and I ran it. And I ran it 13 seconds faster than I had run it before I got sick. It's a very important emotional moment in the race. And I had had a friend who read the book. And the way it initially started was the introduction. And then like chronologically, here's my dad's life. Here's my life. And she was like, you know, before we get into that, we got to understand what running feels like. And I was like, you know, that's right. You know, we got to. And she's like, you should do a like second by second recounting of a race. I was like, really good thought. Then I had to choose the race. And I wrote like 7 different races, right? Like I had different meanings in my life. Well, maybe I'll start with the one where I went the fastest. That'll be a great way to start the book. But no, that doesn't work. It creates a bunch of like chronological problems. And, you know, if you're going to start with the 2019 race, you have to like have a bunch of information in it, you know? Okay. So we can't do that one. All right. So let's try this race because it ties really well with the theme of parenting. Well, that doesn't work because, you know, then it doesn't set up the next chapter very well. So, you know, I went through all these different variations in part because this great feedback from her and now have good chapter one.
That the post cancer
yeah.
makes it a great chapter one. I have no doubt. It's funny you use your wife because I tried my wife once as a reviewer and that lasted about a few hours. And then I'm like, you're done. Even though she'll say she wrote my first book. That's not the truth. But
hard.
In a divorce court, would that stand? I don't know. Not that we're getting divorced anytime soon.
It is tricky. Like there's a real emotional complexity in... You know, sometimes when my wife's she's a dance historian and she's a scholar, and sometimes she'll have me read her work and she'll give it to me and then she'll sort of like sit next to me and then she'll be like, What are you thinking? I'm like, I'm going to go into a different room. And when I'm done and I've got all my thoughts, I will come back and I'll tell you everything. But it's hard. And it's even harder because I'm writing about our kids. I'm writing about our life. Like, you know, and then for my mother, right? And I'm writing about her ex-husband who is, you know, like wasn't so great as an ex-husband, you know? There's a lot of complexity in the feedback I got on this as I went through the process.
When you bring family into a book, yes, there's always subtleties. Yeah. Well, again, the book is out. Go to Amazon or anywhere books are sold. And again, learn a little about life from Nick Thompson's perspective and the things that he can bestow upon you and the nuggets that he can give you from the book. Nick, thanks for coming out, man.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Honored to have you. So great to talk with you. I love being here. You know, absolutely an honor to be on the show with you. Thanks so much.
All right, guys. We'll see you next time.